Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm super excited for this week's show. It is the sequel to one of our most requested episodes, our Heavy Action All-Stars episode from a few years back. We are doing Volume 2, which means I am joined for this very special Heavy Action All-Stars Volume 2 episode by Adam Risky. Hey, Adam.
Hey, so because this is the sequel episode, I feel like we got to increase the budget. The runtime needs to be 20 minutes longer than the last one. We need endorsement deals. We need a hot soundtrack. We need video games. What do you think?
I like where you're at. We need an Animatrix style animated prequel, I feel like.
Attached to Dreamcatcher.
You're the music guy, so you're in charge of putting together the hot soundtrack.
Okay, I'll take that as an action item after the podcast. I will cobble together a hot soundtrack of the choices that we talk about on this show.
I love this plan.
For a column this week, I just revisited The Mummy Returns, and they had my favorite kind of sequel flex, which is the one pop song on your soundtrack. Otherwise, it's just the score. And this time they had the band Live do a song called Forever Is Not Enough.
I have no memory of that.
I listened to it once and I was like, I don't remember this at all. And since I wrote the article, I've listened to it like 30 times. And I don't even like the song. I just liked that it was from The Mummy Returns. And now it's on like my YouTube playlist. And I'm just like, oh, I'm never getting rid of this now.
It's true what they say. Forever is not enough. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about CGI Scorpion Kings, forever is not enough.
Let me tell you, that effect holds up.
It was good in 2002? No.
2001.
2001. Well, that makes sense because it's 20 years later. 2001. It was good in 2001. I can only imagine it's good in 2021.
It looks spectacular. He does not look like a lobster instead of a scorpion. So.
Hey, that gave us The Rock's movie career. He'll come up again later in this episode.
Whoa, spoiler alert.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, he will.
How you feeling? You're double vaccinated now.
Yeah, I'm double vaccinated. That's probably a good place to start because I went back to a movie theater. It was a 399-day gap between Bloodshot and Godzilla versus Kong, but I did go back.
But here we are. So you went back to a movie theater and saw Godzilla versus Kong. How was it?
It was my second time seeing the movie. Right. I did see it on HBO Max. I liked the movie. It didn't get any better or worse in a theater. But the theater experience was not at all what I thought it was going to be that I built up in my head. I thought it was going to be like this Shawshank Redemption ending where I'm hugging it on the beach. And it was really weird. It felt like when I go back to visit my university and I try to go to like the old restaurants I went to 20 years ago. And I'm like, well, this just feels weird now.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if it was because I was in a theater that sat maybe 300 people all by myself. And I don't mean like there was hardly anyone there. I mean like I was the only one.
Think of the money you saved on the private rental.
This is very true. And inside the building was one employee and I saw three other people seeing some other movie. So it was weird. But I'm working my way back into it. I'm sure eventually it'll feel normal again. It was kind of like a catch 22 because I was sort of looking for a showing that didn't have many people. Mm-hmm. But I also didn't want no people because I could have just stayed home to do that.
True. But at least you got the big screen Dolby experience for Godzilla versus Kong.
This is true. Yes, I did. And let me tell you, those podcaster scenes really pop in Dolby.
I kept wondering as I watched it on my home television, what would this be like in Atmos?
Yeah, totally. I would never listen to that podcast.
No, I wouldn't either. But we don't live in a world in which monsters exist, so maybe that's why.
Well, no, I just think that I could tell by the structure I wouldn't be happy with it.
Are they sponsored by MeUndies?
I've totally lost on that joke.
Oh, that's a big sponsor of podcasts. It's called MeUndies.
Gotcha.
It's like underwear that gets shipped to your house, I think. I try to fast forward most podcast sponsorships, so I don't really know the details about MeUndies, but it's what they're called.
I would have called it Mundies, and then I would have gotten that woman from Office Space. It's like, sounds like someone's got a case of the Mundies. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is why you have the job that you do.
Munder pants? Monday pants. No.
Monday pants. Just call them Monday pants.
That's my alias when I go out to bars.
Monday pants?
I'm Mitchell Monday pants. But my friends call me the pants.
Well, sure.
And then when I bump into Joe Pantoliano, he's just like, I thought I was the pants.
No. He doesn't know Mitchell Monday pants.
He doesn't know.
Who sounds like maybe like the fourth or fifth lead in a Bond film.
To me, it sounded like a syndicated WGN show starring Richard Dean Anderson.
I would watch that. I've started watching Stargate SG-1 since my podcast on Stargate with Robin, and I'm only like five or six episodes in. And boy, Richard Dean Anderson is not. I'm not warming to him.
Yeah, I was never a Richard Dean Anderson guy, but. Speaking of syndicated WGN TV shows or movies that feel like one, I watched Chaos Walking last night.
Oh boy, what did Mitchell Monday Pants think of that?
I did not like it. It was like, it felt like the perfect movie to double with Jonah Hex.
That is not an endorsement.
Did you ever see? Do you ever watch those Sci-Fi Channel movies that have Bruce Campbell in them that were from like the early 2000s, like The Man with Two Brains or any of that stuff, or Terminal
Man, The Man with the Screaming Brain? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, that was it.
The Man with Two Brains is Steve Martin, and that movie rules.
Yeah, I made a Monday pants slip. No, it was, The Man with the Screaming Brain and like Terminal Invasion and Icebreaker. It felt like there was one specifically called Alien Apocalypse, which basically took place in like this lumberyard, and there were aliens who were like keeping all the people hostage, and they were all dressed in rags and they were in servitude. And that's kind of it was like a big budget version of that. With Chaos Walking, and it was like really, really like, I don't often say this about movies, but it was just like, while I was watching it, I was like, this is just lame. And I feel lame like being a part of this, but I didn't hate it. It was just so batting for a single that I was just like, what is this? And then the conceit of the movie is just on its face kind of obnoxious, because it's this planet, like an Earth 2, where all the women are gone and all the men have, because of the planets, like the atmosphere or something, but all the men have their thoughts audible and visible, like in these little like thought clouds. So you can't hide anything from anyone. And then the lead character is Tom Holland, and he keeps saying like, be a man, control your noise, and all this stuff like that. And he says it like over and over and over again to himself. And let me tell you, that's not cinematic nor fun.
This movie sounds terrible. I didn't know that was the conceit. I didn't know the conceit of the movie was like sci-fi what women want.
It basically is, yeah. Oof. It feels like you bought like a 24-pack of Shasta Cola and drank it by yourself. So if you're into that, then Chaos Walking is the movie for you.
Wow.
It's like... going to Taco Bell, not ordering any food, and just saying, I just want some sauce.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Going, yeah. I also watched a documentary that Severin put out about horror anthologies.
I watched this too.
You did?
Yeah, I borrowed it from JB.
Nice. It is called Tales of the Uncanny, and I thought it was pleasant. And
that's a nice way of putting it.
There were a lot of Zoom interviews, and I kind of wanted them to just maybe wait until they could do it without the Zoom interviews. But it kind of sucked the energy out of the movie a little bit. But I will say that it put me on to a few anthologies that I haven't seen yet that I want to seek out for Scary Movie Month. And I had thought that I'd seen everything. So I picked up like Spirits of the Dead I want to watch, and the TV version of Dead of Night, and From Beyond the Grave. So at least for that reason, I thought it was pleasant enough.
Yeah, I just felt like it really was just like, and then there's this anthology. I don't know what I want from some of these documentaries.
Yeah.
Because I recently saw one on folk horror that was over 3 hours long and exhaustive, but still was just like, and also this is folk horror, and also this is folk horror. I don't know if I require these movies to have a thesis or to have more of a structure, but it, even as a sampling, I thought Tales of the Uncanny was kind of disappointing, and maybe it was because I've seen most, if not all, of these movies that there was, maybe that's what I wanted out of it, because I remember watching one on Giallo movies before I had seen very many of them, and it was very exciting. And so it was like, ooh, there's all these movies that I want to see now. So maybe it comes with like not being super exposed to a lot of them, because Yellow Fever, the Giallo one, was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to watch all these movies. My world is opening up. And with the anthology one, I was like, right, okay, check, got it, yeah, seen it, okay. It felt very kind of just repetitive and sort of, I hate to use the word basic, but it felt a little bit basic. Like, horror noir, great documentary, has a point of view, has something to say. Isn't just like, and also here's this horror movie that stars black people. And maybe I was looking for more of that from Tales of the Uncanny.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, like, I've seen, there's one documentary that I won't name, but it's on Shudder.
I know the one.
and
then there's this movie, and then this movie came out.
And it's like, yeah, if you've seen all the movies, it's like watching Jurassic Park for the 500th time. You're just checking boxes.
Exactly. And so, it's fine as like to put on at a party or to like have on as background noise, but it's not a documentary, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, like, I guess the way I'm rationalizing it is, it was worth my whatever $25 purchase because I got three recommendations.
Dead of Night, the one that they talk about, Dead of Night, the one segment that they really focus on, is really, really good. And I think Dead of Night is on Shudder.
Okay, I'll need to check that out.
The TV movie.
And then I watched another documentary, and you know I'm all about like the movie theater documentaries and like
pop culture that. Yeah.
So I found like the most avant-garde version of one of like the fluff pop culture documentary. It's called The Projectionist, and the difference with this one is it's directed by Abel Ferrara, inexplicably.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it, obviously.
So it's about a guy from Cyprus, and he immigrated to New York with his family like decades ago, and now he runs movie theaters in New York, and it follows him from like the 42nd Street era. With the adult film houses and everything, to like more of the revitalization of New York with Bloomberg and all that stuff. And kind of like it stops in around like the time period with Blade Runner 2049. And it shows him just like running these neighborhood theaters. And he has one specific theater that he has for like super micro indie movies, and his rationale is just like, I keep it going, I make no money off of this, but these filmmakers deserve to have a place to show their movies. So that's why I keep this here. Even though nobody attends, they deserve to have it. So he's sort of like this, you know, great guy because he's a film fan and he seems like just sort of like a mensch and like likes to, you know, keep people in the neighborhood active and coming to his theater. But the weirdest thing about this is because it's Abel Ferrara, almost all of the film clips that he intersperses have male genitalia in them. So like you'll hear this anecdote and it's like this nice anecdote, and then they'll show like a clip from like this movie where a guy's wearing like a cockatoo costume, but then his dick is just hanging out, and then somebody's like praying at his ankles, and you're just like, what? What? And then they show a scene, and then Abel Ferrara is on camera for part of it, so they'll show a scene where like he's at one of the theaters and he'll go up to a couple of, like a group of women in line. And it's my favorite part of the movie because he goes up to this group of women and they instinctually just start stepping backwards when he approaches them. And then he's just like, what are you girls going to see? And then they're like, Battle of the Sexes. And he's like, hey, we got a Battle of the Sexes right here. And then it's weird that it's called The Projectionist, though, because it deals very little with like this guy being a projectionist at any point. Although another one of my favorite like little weird things that go on in this movie is in the projection booth in one of the theaters, they show it's like the poster for Elizabethtown, but every part of the poster is cut out except for the full Kirsten Dunst. And it's like, I get it, but also that's creepy. So the movie's like 80 minutes long. I rented it on YouTube. I would say for like a few bucks. If you think this sounds interesting, I would recommend it. It's kind of a nice little movie.
Yeah, I just would be curious to see what an Abel Ferrara documentary would look like.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's very like this is the type of movie that would play at like the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Right. Because it's directed by Abel Ferrara.
For sure. Yeah. And then the last one I'll talk about is my Spotlight Showcase pick for
I love that you bring that back.
So it's called Boogie, and it was a movie that was released in theaters in March. It is the directorial debut by a guy named Eddie Huang, who was an executive producer, I believe, on the show Fresh Off the Boat.
Okay.
That Randall Park and Constance Wu were on. And the way I could describe it best is that it's the Wish Upon version of He Got Game.
Okay.
It is so funny, and I don't know how much of it is intentional, but like within like the first 10 minutes, there's like the Asian basketball player who's the lead character saying Jeremy Lin can suck my dick. And I'm like, oh, this movie's got no rules. I can't wait to see where this is going. He tells the female love interest that she's got a good looking vagina in the same scene. There's a scene where that woman who's played by Taylor Page, who is going to be in a movie called Zola coming up that was at Sundance. They stop the scene because she just goes, I gotta pee. And then the scene is over.
What is going on?
And then my favorite part of it, though, is the internal logic of this movie is insane because Boogie is one of the three best like playground street ball high school players in the New York City area.
As was I.
He's got to beat this guy named Monk. And his dad and Boogie's dad keeps going, you know, if you beat Monk, we got a chance at the NBA. I'm like, that's not how this works. And then it doesn't make any sense because on one hand, they're like, if you beat Monk, you get a chance at the NBA. But then every college recruiter is just like, we're not offering Boogie a scholarship, but he could walk on the team. And I'm like, if you could play in the NBA, you would get a scholarship at least a D1 school, let alone like maybe D2, D3, if the D1 school wouldn't play you. And then, like, China hears about him and wants him. And I'm like, he's just this punk kid from New York.
He's Boogie. Hello. He's Boogie.
And then they show the basketball games, and it looks like everybody's playing like full court defense for every play. So like he's got these wide open lanes and basically will just run up and do a layup. And I'm just like, that's not how the NBA works. So Boogie is kind of a mess. It's sort of like a Streetcar Named Desire in terms of it's like overcooked melodrama because there's all this like family stuff. The guy who plays Bruce Lee from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the guy trying to recruit him to the Chinese team. He's like, he's like trying to blackmail him into playing in China.
You do not blackmail Boogie.
You don't. No, no. I'll tell you afterwards, but it kind of works anyway.
What's that insane basketball movie that you and Rob wrote about?
Slammajama.
Slammajama. Would you double this with Slammajama?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not as incompetent, no offense, as Slammajama, but it's a movie as a fever dream. So I would definitely recommend it. I rented it for $20. I would maybe wait until it comes out on Redbox.
Remember early in the pandemic when $20 would buy you a movie you didn't want, like Bloodshot or The Way Back?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been so quarantined that like when I see, if Boogie was like $30, I would have been like, sure. So yeah, I would definitely recommend Boogie. It's a trip.
Wow. All right. Yeah, I might wait until it's like a Redbox deal. I don't think I'm spending $20 on Boogie.
Yeah. You don't have that NBA money.
I do not. Though I could easily walk on to the NBA only if I beat Monk.
You gotta beat Monk.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
And Monk, I assume, is played by Tony Shalhoub.
No, I wish. It's played by a rapper named Pop Smoke.
Oh, Pop Smoke.
But Pop Smoke, we can't make fun of Pop Smoke because Pop Smoke died last year. So rest in peace, Pop Smoke.
R.I.P. P.S.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
I only have a couple that I'll talk about. The first is The Stand-In, which is a new comedy starring Drew Barrymore, in which she plays a dual role as herself, the spoiled, miserable, alcoholic actor star of many successful comedies, and then her own stand-in, who's a wannabe actor who sort of takes over her life when she checks into rehab. And it's not funny, and it's mostly just an excuse to hear Drew Barrymore say the word fuck a lot. I guess that was like, well, I'm doing a grown-up comedy, so we swear in this one. But she plays two unlikable characters, which is almost impossible for me to conceive of because I really like Drew Barrymore. I think she comes across as likable in most of her movies. And I don't want to suggest that she only do like romantic comedies, but that's money in the bank. Like Drew Barrymore in a romantic comedy is a slam dunk to paraphrase Boogie. And so to see her just do this kind of garbage was very disappointing. Like, I think she's a really talented comedic actor. I think back to something like Never Been Kissed, which, to be fair, has its problems. You know, I feel like in 1999 we were kind of like, wait, this is weird. Why is the teacher dating the student? And now in 2021 it's inconceivable that Never Been Kissed ever gets made because Michael Vartan is, what's he doing in that movie? Why did we try to make Michael Vartan happen, by the way? Like, why was that a thing?
Because he's got like a thin face. I don't know.
The fact that I know his name bothers me.
He looks like a watch ad, so I don't know.
It's nothing against Michael Vartan. I know he has fans. You know, he's in The Pallbearer. I like that movie. I think we talked about that the last time you were on when we talked about Sheryl Crow's I Shall Believe.
Yeah. Great song. City of Angels podcast, big ups.
Big ups to the C of A, PC. I just want to talk about The Pallbearer on more episodes. So The Stand-In, not great. It's on Netflix if you want to, I guess, expose yourself to it or see what I'm talking about. Today, I finally watched The Nun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I do know why. It's because there's been so much talk about Bonnie Ahrens in Jacob's Wife, because she plays kind of like the head vampire in Jacob's Wife. And then I found out, oh, she also plays the nun in The Nun.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time people saying, like, oh, it's kind of good. And I remember people saying that it had, like, Fulci vibes. And so I watched it, and about 10 minutes in, I was like, oh, okay, a nun hangs herself very early in this movie, recalling the opening of City of the Living Dead. So maybe that's why they were saying it has Fulci vibes, or because it's sort of about Catholicism in a loose way, or because there's a lot of fog. I really was looking for the Fulci vibes, but the movie did not work for me. I found it slow and nonsensical, and to be fair, the movie was at a disadvantage from the outset because, A, I'm not into, like, slow supernatural horror so much, except for when it's really good, and B, I'm not into, like, religious horror. So I was not the audience for The Nun, to be fair. I don't know how into the Conjuring universe I am. I like those two Conjuring movies. I've yet to see an Annabelle movie. So this was my first exposure to, like, the side universe Conjuring movies, but it wasn't a great experience.
My rule of thumb with the Conjuring universe movies is if Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga show up, it's watchable or good, and if they're not, then usually those are the also-rans.
They're in the opening and closing of this, but it's just like scenes from The Conjuring 2, I think.
My theory is wrong. I take it back. although it's just a movie that I had zero expectations for and love. Annabelle Comes Home is wonderful, and I kind of think it's like one of the best horror movies of the past couple of years.
Wow. All right. Well, then I need to watch the first two Annabelles to lead up to that.
I don't know if you do.
Well, I can't just go right into Annabelle Comes Home. That's crazy talk.
I know Annabelle Comes Home has like a group of fandom, but Annabelle, the first one, I think I'm the only one who liked. And then everybody liked Annabelle Resurrection or whatever the hell it was called.
What is it called? I don't know what it's called. Resurrection sounds right. Let's just call it that.
That's the thing that's happening to me with my old age is I'm forgetting titles.
Oh, me too. Believe me.
Yeah. Annabelle Regeneration was the one that everybody liked that David Sandberg directed, and I thought it was just garbage, so I don't know. Go figure. What'd you think of Nobody? You watched Nobody.
Yeah, that was my next one. I thought it was okay. I didn't love it, and I'm seeing a lot of love for it online, which I won't say surprises me, but it was not my experience. I think part of the issue for me, like, I liked watching Bob Odenkirk kick ass. I thought some of the action was well done. I thought especially in that last shootout, there were some inventive gags. I had just watched John Wick Chapter 2 earlier that day with my son, and I was a little burned out on Nobody's shtick, because it's basically just the John Wick thing. I thought it really overused the idea of, like, let's play an old Frank Sinatra song.
Oh, my God.
While we contrast it with violence, or, you know, it does this one thing over and over and over again. There's a bus fight early on in the movie that I kind of sat up because I was like, well, this is really interesting. And if this is what the movie's going to be, I'm really on board for this, because it suggests an almost Taxi Driver like character study of a guy who wishes people would fuck with him because he's looking for a fight. And it shoots the violence in such a way where it's very messy, and it hurts, and it matters, and things have impact. And I was like, this could be really interesting. And then the movie really isn't that. And I don't want to hold it against the movie for not being what I wanted it to be, but it goes into a much more standard, like, I'm a super soldier and all this government nonsense, and a villain who's not especially interesting, and motivations that don't totally make sense. And I just had a lot of issues with it. But that bus sequence I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I like that bus sequence. That happens sort of early in the movie. It's kind of the inciting, or one of the inciting incidents. But I don't know, for me, like, I think it was just the mood I was in, or maybe it was just because I had seen like 20 other action movies prior yeah, to that over the past few weeks.
Yeah.
But like, I found it just like really nihilistic in a way that the John Wick movies don't feel to me.
Okay.
And it sucks because like, I know this is the type of movie where I hold it up as this one example, but I'm being like a complete hypocrite, because it's just doing the same thing that like tons of other movies like Bad Boys 2 or something's doing. But I don't know, just for this, for some reason, this one felt very like, you're not a man unless you're violent, and like, how, look how cool guns are. And I don't know why, it just like that day, it just hit me in like the complete wrong way. And I really didn't like it.
Yeah. No, I get it. I think, yeah, the director whose last movie I really didn't like, Hardcore Henry, I liked this a lot better than Hardcore Henry.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit smug in terms of like rubbing your nose in the violence in kind of a bratty, isn't this cool, isn't this fun way.
It reminded me of Shoot 'Em Up.
Yeah, I mean, it has that same attitude.
That's the humor, yeah.
I haven't seen Shoot 'Em Up in a long time.
Yeah.
I don't remember loving it.
When you said Nobody's Shtick, that made me think it would be a great title for a sequel to Nobody's Fool.
Which is a movie that not enough people have seen, including me.
It's on Amazon Prime, and I've been meaning to see it for 25 years.
Because Bruce Willis plays a supporting role?
I don't know what it is. It's just one of those movies that came out around the time Demon Knight did, and I chose Demon Knight, and I feel like I need to catch up, because all the times that I should have seen Ready to Wear or...
Yeah, I saw Ready to Wear in a theater, by the way.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Pret-a-porter.
I did. I went with a friend who, like, I didn't hang out with that much, and she and I were like, let's go to a movie. And I think maybe Altman's last movie before that was Shortcuts, and I loved Shortcuts so much that I was like, well, surely Ready to Wear will be great, because it's Robert Altman. And it's not great.
I still need to see Murder in the First.
Is that the Kevin Bacon, Gary Oldman one?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that one either.
I still need to see Death of the Maiden.
Nope, never saw that one.
I'm just going off of memory. I'm not even looking at this, like, a list.
This is impressive.
I just know so well what came out around the same time as Demon Knight.
I would rather rewatch Demon Knight than see any of those for the first time.
This is true. This is true. Demon Knight is a perfect movie.
It is rad. So let's get into our heavy action all-stars, with the disclaimer for those of you listening who are big action fans. I know people that listen, like Michael Scott, who does the Adkins Undisputed podcast, who was nice enough to have both of us on that podcast. Like, these are not action people, really. Like, these are not, if you're a hardcore action fan, that's not who we're talking about. You know, we kind of ran through the 10 really big ones on the first installment. And so this time around, we're not talking about people like Scott Adkins or Tony Jaa or, you know, Iko Uwais, or like people that you would associate with action if you're a hardcore action fan. These are much more kind of mainstream actors who are known for doing action but aren't necessarily like – hardcore action people. Does that make sense? Am I explaining us correctly?
That makes sense. And I also want to add that there are certain actors that I think you could cover, like a Charles Bronson or a Chuck Norris, but I just don't have the wealth of knowledge to do so. So we have a few that are actors that have dabbled into the action realm, right, but also are known for, you know, dramas and comedies and all sorts of other genres.
Yeah. So do you want to just go back and forth and pick our stars and then talk about our movie? So the idea is we picked 10 actors, and then each of us chooses a movie of that actor that we feel is maybe a little underappreciated, isn't one of their more obvious hits. And so each of us gets to talk about those. So Adam, I will let you go first and choose our first all-star.
Okay. I will go with Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson as our first pick.
Previously mentioned as the Lobster King.
As the Lobster King. My underrated pick for him is a disaster movie that he did from 2015, San Andreas.
Yes.
Which I'm not the biggest Dwayne Johnson fan. I like his early stuff prior to maybe his run in the Fast and Furious franchise better than like his pop after the Fast and Furious boost. But San Andreas, I think of the second group is the best one, or my favorite one at least. I have a lot of just fondness for this movie because I saw it on opening day at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood. And let me tell you, that is the place to see a disaster movie. And I also realized that I've seen two Dwayne Johnson / Alexandra Daddario movies in California with this and Baywatch. So it seems like when I'm in L.A., I have to go see a Rock Daddario.
I forgot that Baywatch existed.
Good for you. I did not. And San Andreas is just like, I like disaster movies. This one, I think, gets all the beats right. It's got a lot of destruction. It's like probably like millions of people die in this movie. It's crazy, the collateral damage that happens. But some of the CGI is really great. Some of it is kind of spotty. But there's like this little subplot with Alexandra Daddario, like, having to team up with these two British brothers and go around the city. And it's very charming in kind of like an odd way, like a Poseidon Adventure type of way. I'm sad that they dropped Kylie Minogue out of a building in the first 20 minutes of the movie, 'cause she's delightful. But I don't know. I mean, like, The Rock is likable. It's a good disaster movie. It's no better or worse than like a Volcano or Dante's Peak. But I if you dig the genre, I think it's one that's not really talked about that much.
And I think ultimately that's what's holding me back, is that I don't really dig the genre. I'm not a disaster movie guy. Like, I haven't seen Volcano or Dante's Peak. I've tried my hand at a number of disaster movies, and every time they just kind of leave me cold. And part of it is that I just can't rationalize the carnage. Like, it's hard for me to give a shit if The Rock finds his daughter when millions of people are dying around him. It's which is stupid. I need to buy into the conceit of the movie. And honestly, I'm probably more inclined towards like 70s disaster movies, just because there are like ensemble pieces more than star vehicles, the way that San Andreas is, and B, because they were shooting stuff practically. Because now you watch these disaster movies, and it's true of like even something like, you know, Godzilla versus Kong, like, you can do anything on a computer, and so it loses some of the wonder, it loses some of the magic, where like, wow, look what they staged, look what they pulled off, because it's just ones and zeros, you know, buildings collapsing and the ground opening up and fireballs and all that shit. I still like had a perfectly fine time watching San Andreas. I'm not bagging on San Andreas. It's just not my kind of movie. But any movie in which Carla Gugino and Alexandra Daddario star is going to be worth my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I hear you. It's especially egregious too, kind of in this movie, because Dwayne Johnson is like a rescue helicopter pilot, and he just like completely foregoes any type of occupation.
He's not rescuing anyone but his daughter.
He just like is hijacking vehicles to go like, and even by like dumb logic standpoints, like the coincidences of them finding their daughter are real crazy. It's it's something, but
it also doesn't really like do that disaster movie thing where it's giving you enough people to root against. It's really just Yoan Griffith, or however you say his name, Mr. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And spoilers, you know, he has a car or something gets dropped on him, a bridge, or I can't remember what lands on him, but like
a shipping container.
Oh, thank you. Okay. I guess we're supposed to like stand up and cheer when that happens. I felt no joy, even though he's a douche and, you know, abdicates his responsibility very early on and is slimy and we're not supposed to like him. And he leaves Alexander Daddario to die, which is an inexcusable crime. But that moment where he gets the shipping container dropped on him is like, I guess, supposed to be fun. And I have a hard time being like, yay, haha, you got what's coming.
Well, it's weirdly placed because it happens, I think, on the Golden Gate Bridge. And like, meanwhile, hundreds of people are like also drowning and like getting crushed and swept away by a tidal wave. So you gotta separate it out. You can't do both at the same time.
Now I haven't seen Skyscraper. Is that worth seeing?
Oh no, it's terrible. It's like the worst type of Hollywood like bowing to global markets type of movie.
Okay,
where you could tell like it's just trying to be everything to everyone when, and it ends up being nothing.
Well, San Andreas made me realize I don't really like green screen movies, and Skyscraper seems like a green screen movie.
Yeah, it definitely is. Skyscraper's got like shit in it, like all the people in China are watching The Rock like hanging from like a scaffolding, but it's on like a I don't even know, like 500-inch like LCD TV, and they're just standing in like a Times Square type of area watching him hang.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, that totally happens always.
Well, my pick for Dwayne The Rock Johnson is Walking Tall, which was like his third starring role. Is that right? After The Scorpion King and The Rundown.
I feel like
this was fairly early on, and it's very modest. It's a remake of a movie I haven't seen. To be fair, I've not seen, I want to say it was like Joe Don Baker in the original Walking Tall. And I never saw it, but I have seen this version several times. It is still like a WWE film. It's still produced by Vince McMahon, so The Rock is still working under WWE, and they're controlling kind of what he does. But it's essentially, it's like, I think we timed it, we were texting each other, it's like 76 minutes before credits, is that right?
Yeah.
And
then the credits are like 12 minutes.
Yeah. So it gets in and out, and it's really just 76 minutes of The Rock beating people up, which I'm on board for. He comes back to his town and finds that it's been overrun by Neil McDonough. He of the bleached blonde hair and steely blue eyes, who's opened up a casino and is running the town and selling drugs and doing all kinds of terrible things. And so The Rock becomes the sheriff and cleans up the town and beats people up in a casino in a very satisfying way. And there's a big fight in like a steel mill that happens at the end of the movie, because of course it's going to end there. I just find it a very breezy and entertaining 76 minutes, and I like when The Rock was making slightly smaller scale movies like this.
So before I get into what I think of the movie, I gotta say, McDonough and Daddario need to do like a Godzilla versus Kong, but they can only like shoot blue at each other's eyes.
I like it.
It's crazy how blue those two actors' eyes are. Walking Tall is a perfect movie. It's by far Dwayne Johnson's best movie.
Really?
It's one of the best movies of 2004, maybe one of the best movies of the 20th century or the 21st century.
I was not ready for this at all.
I adore Walking Tall. Because it's only 75 minutes, shit escalates fast.
Very fast, yeah.
Johnny Knoxville, who's like a total debit to your action sidekick, because he's jackassing it up, and it's great because it's a lot of like hand-to-hand fist fighting and sloppy violence. I like my Dwayne Johnson with a little bit of an edge to him, and this is still when he'd had that, where he kind of like isn't the infallible hero. Like, he does a lot of stuff in it that's pretty bad too. He basically by the end of the movie becomes Alonzo Harris from Training Day. But I mean, it's got like Michael Bowen as like one of the henchmen, and he's great at playing just like creep.
Has he ever played like a nice guy ever?
No, because I mean, like Night of the Comet, Kill Bill.
Right, you know, going back to Valley Girl, like he's a scumbag in Valley Girl.
Yeah, yeah. I just love this movie. It's also one of those like Gone Country type of action movies.
Oh, your favorite.
And I dig those, even though this is like in kind of like a rural Washington, so it's not like the South. But yeah, Walking Tall, like if you don't own this movie on multiple formats, what are you doing?
Better supporting performance, better supporting Johnny Knoxville, this or The Last Stand?
I'd have to rewatch The Last Stand. I've only seen it the one time. But
oh my gosh,
I mean,
it rules. You need to rewatch it.
Yeah, I definitely do. I love that movie, though. Yeah. But I'll go, just because I'm so fond of Walking Tall, I gotta go Walking Tall.
Sure. Whatever happened to Ashley Scott?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, was this the first thing she was in?
Was this before Into the Blue or after?
I think this was before.
Okay.
I've never seen Into the Blue, should I?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding?
Okay. No, I'm not kidding.
No, you should totally see Into the Blue. That's like such a you movie. Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. She was in SWAT. She was Gigolo Jane in AI Artificial Intelligence.
I don't remember Gigolo Jane. I also don't remember her from Just Friends.
I don't either. She was in The Kingdom, which no one remembers.
I saw it. I saw Strange Wilderness. I mean, I'm looking at her IMDb, and like I've seen a lot of
stuff. Strange Wilderness too.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff she's in, but I don't.
Strange Wilderness. I gotta stop us talking about action movies because I gotta go off on Strange Wilderness. That was like I was chasing Grandma's Boy.
Me too.
And it did not work out.
I laughed so hard. I'm gonna spoil Strange Wilderness. It's like 80 unfunny minutes of them trying to find Bigfoot, and then they do, and they just shoot it. And I laughed really hard when they shot Bigfoot.
Oh man, I don't even remember that. But
that's the only thing I remember about Strange Wilderness is like shock and surprise as they shoot, they just blow Bigfoot away. And I laughed really hard at that, but I don't remember the rest of the movie. I just remember not really laughing.
I miss fratty comedies from the early 2000s, like the Grandma's Boy and like all the Broken Lizard stuff. That was good times.
Accepted. That's a good one.
That is a good one.
I like that one.
Yeah. Justin Long also, if you see him at a convention, go up and meet him. He's a good guy. Good guy.
He's a good guy.
I think he's not Jewish, so he is a good guy.
All right.
Yeah. There you go.
So I had no idea you loved Walking Tall as much as you do.
Yeah.
This is a revelation, but I'm excited for it. I'm here for it.
Yeah, I kind of want to get a framed poster, but I want to go overboard with it and get like those blinking lights around it, like it's at a like it's a premiere.
I need to rewatch The Rundown to see if I like that or this better.
Yeah, I've only seen The Rundown once. I need to go back to that. Yeah, and Into the Blue.
Oh my gosh, you totally Into the Blue is like just two gorgeous people swimming for like an hour, and then it goes crazy and it gets super violent. And yeah, no, you definitely need to see it.
It's got Scott Kahn, and it's directed by John Stockwell.
Yep.
What am I doing with my life?
Yeah, no, I really feel like that movie's up your alley.
All right, I'm into it. I'm writing it down.
I remember seeing it opening night, and when it gets into that last half hour being like, what the hell is going on? Josh Brolin at kind of a career low point playing the villain in Into the Blue before his revival, thanks to the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the best when you're like watching a movie and you're just like, this is made by insane people and I was not expecting
yes.
that.
Yes! John Stockwell.
There's a few of those insane in this list for of the action movies. It's great stuff.
Yeah. All right, I will go next, and I will tear the Band-Aid off because we need to get to it because we've literally been counting down via text, and I will say Harrison Ford for our next pick. Now, Harrison Ford is not a guy I generally consider to be an action guy outside of, like, the Indiana Jones franchise, but he has made some other action movies. My pick is more of an action comedy and probably one that leads way more with comedy than action. And that is Hollywood Homicide, directed by Ron Shelton, in which Harrison Ford partners up with a young Josh Hartnett to solve crimes in Los Angeles and also sell real estate. And that's the thing that I like about Hollywood Homicide is how much it's about these two cops who would rather be doing almost anything else, that they both have their side hustles. Josh Hartnett wants to be an actor. Harrison Ford wants to sell real estate, and that the cop stuff is almost incidental. I mean, it still works as a cop movie. It's Ron Shelton, and I like most Ron Shelton movies. I feel like whatever he did last, I didn't love, but I can't remember what his last movie was.
Just Getting Started.
Yeah, that's I didn't even see it, so there you go. But in my head, I cataloged, like, there's a Ron Shelton movie I don't care about. Oh, it's Just Getting Started. That's the one on the golf cart, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I have you to thank for my knowledge of that.
You're welcome.
But Hollywood Homicide is a really good hangout movie. Harrison Ford is at his grouchy best. There's a point at which he steals a bike from a child and just screams at him in this way that is all the rage and frustration he's been feeling for years all come out in this moment, and it never fails to make me laugh. Josh Hartnett, very appealing. And then you have like a supporting cast that includes Lena Olin and Isaiah Washington and Lolita Davidovich, aka Mrs. Shelton. And I really like this movie. It's a movie I've kind of beaten the drum for many years.
Yeah, I'm with you. This was only the second time I'd seen it. I saw it in the theaters, and I liked it then, and I liked it just as much now. And I agree with you. Like, all the real estate stuff is so watchable yeah. that I could watch, like, an entire TV series of Harrison Ford as moonlighting cop trying to sell real estate. Like, and then, like, yeah, like, the third act of every episode is, like, him selling a house to Master P. Like, that would be
right.
Yeah, this movie is like super, super dated because of like, all the like, God, what was the name of the record label? Like Murder, Inc. type
right,
stuff.
Right, right, right.
It was right in that era.
Right,
era. And yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of, it almost works to the movie's benefit how little chemistry Ford and Hartnett have with each other. It makes for this like really uncomfortable dynamic, and like Josh Hartnett isn't—he's a very sincere actor, but I wouldn't describe him as like a funny actor. But I think like the scene of him performing "Streetcar Named Desire" at the end, somehow it like it goes so like not funny that it culminates into being like hilarious at the end.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. I just love grouchy Harrison Ford, and like the early 2000s was him at his most rudderless between like this and like Extraordinary Measures and Firewall and stuff. And you could just see him like wearing that grumpiness, and it's really fun. I don't know if you're in the right mood for it. Like I think Hollywood Homicide is a real fun movie.
Yeah, I do too. Firewall was almost going to be my pick for this until Adam mercifully reminded me of Hollywood Homicide's existence. And then I'm like, oh, I don't have to watch Firewall for a second time.
I still kind of want to watch Firewall.
I think it's on Tubi.
Okay, I'm gonna put it under it into the blue.
Yeah, my list. Definitely. You should definitely prioritize Into the Blue.
Yes. Okay, so my pick is a movie that I'm the world's biggest fan of. I've searched far and wide, and that is 1997's The Devil's Own, which is just as much a drama or thriller as it is an action movie, but I'm not going to miss an opportunity to talk about The Devil's Own. So this is a movie that I'm going to need to be talked down from a little bit from, because I'm so high on, like, I don't understand why people don't think this movie's awesome. Like, I just don't get it. Like, I think it's like a really good, like, Harrison Ford cop drama. Like, I think that's the best part of the movie, I think, is kind of just the day to day of him being kind of like, you know, walking a beat and being like an aging police officer. The Brad Pitt stuff is not as successful. It's one of those movies that's like capital Irish underlined in italics. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just kind of fun to like kind of take pot shots at like Brad Pitt's Irish accent. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I just always get like wrapped up in it, and I'm not like ironically loving on it. I just think it's like a really engaging movie with like an interesting dynamic of these two men. However, I do think it's kind of weird in the sense that I don't know if the movie knows how we're supposed to feel about the Brad Pitt character, who's, you know, can be rationalized as being, you know, a freedom fighter, but it can also be rationalized as being a violent terrorist. So it's sort of an uncomfortable dynamic, but I think the movie is very interesting.
I'm much more on board for the Harrison Ford as a cop stuff in New York and his stuff with Reuben Blades and their partnership and what eventually happens between them, I think is so much more interesting. The Brad Pitt stuff for me does not work as well. And part of that, honestly, is Brad Pitt's performance. I think I love Brad Pitt as an actor. I think he's aged into being a great actor. I think there was a time when he needed the right role. You know, as much as I love something like Meet Joe Black, like, Brad Pitt is not great in that movie. And that was just a year after this. I think he's borderline disastrous in The Devil's Own. I just think it was a mistake to cast him and to let him do that accent, and I'm fighting with every fiber of my being, like, doing Brad Pitt as the Irish. I was baptized in it.
That's okay. Just do it, man. Because, you know, I've been wanting to do the Harrison Ford from this movie for a
while. It's
on my family.
That's very good. For a long time, my sister and I would just quote the trailer to each other. We would just see each other and say, "I need that money, Tom." And then I saw a Janine Garofalo stand-up special where she talked about this movie, and I used to watch that special all the time because I was in love with her. I had it on tape, so I would just rewatch it, and she talked about how good this movie was, and I was like, well, I definitely need to see The Devil's Own. And then I watched it, and I was kind of like, huh? It's certainly an interesting attempt at sort of this action thriller drama for adults, and, you know, pulling in all the political subtext and stuff. I mean, I appreciate what it's trying to do. It just doesn't work for me as well as it does for you.
Right. Yeah. I also remember this came out in a time period. It was like early 1997. And it seemed like every movie playing at the movie theaters had Harrison Ford in it, because it was like when all the Star Wars re-releases came out.
Oh, yeah, right. And Air Force One was that year, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was a good time. It was a great 6 months. And I had seen, you know, the first three Star Wars movies in theaters with my friends. And then we were just like primed on Ford. We were like, let's keep this party going. Let's go see The Devil's Own. So we went opening night, and they were all like making fun of it. And then I, like, it was one of the few times I've ever done this where I turned to them in the theater and I was like, will you guys just shut up? because I was so defensive about my love of the episode.
So from day one, you've loved this movie.
Yeah.
Literally from day one.
It hits me right in my Peggy Canaanes.
Did anybody like offer you a Sprite and you would say like, I was baptized in it?
I should have. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to start saying when anybody offers me anything.
Yeah. I like how.
Want some barbecue sauce for those chicken tenders? Oh, barbecue sauce. I was baptized in it.
Chicken tenders. That sounds fantastic. No, my favorite Brad Pitt line in this is just like, he's like, you're stupid man, Mr. Burke. Stupid man.
I love Brad Pitt. I don't like to watch a Brad Pitt performance that doesn't work for me, but that is the case in this movie, unfortunately. And I have to admit, Harrison Ford is not one of my guys. Like, I love him as Indiana Jones. Yeah, I love him as Indiana Jones. I love him as Han Solo. Like, in the right movie, I love Harrison Ford, but, like, in a lot of movies, I could take or leave him. He's not, like, he doesn't automatically engender my sympathy or, like, he's just not one of my guys.
Oh, he's one of my dad actors, like Costner. Like,
sure.
Where I just feel like, I feel completely safe when Harrison Ford's on screen. Like, okay. He's going to be the Boy Scout and know exactly what to do.
Yeah,
he's my guy. I also have to admit to a movie shame. I know it's supposed to, like, make me roll my eyes back to the back of my head when I see, like, you know, like two Irish dudes like kicking a can down the street and they play like an Irish jig. But like, I love that shit. I don't know why. Like when they're playing pool against the Italians, I'm like, yes. I'm like, this is what America's all about. Come on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. So next pick, I'm going to go with Liam Neeson.
Okay. Speaking of Irish.
This is true. Except he tries to hide the Irish most of the time.
Yeah.
So I'm not the biggest Liam Neeson guy when it comes to his action movies because there's so many of them. Like, I can't keep up with it anymore. And I think it's kind of incredible that he doesn't have, like, a DTV catalog at this point. My favorite, though, is the one that I'm picking for this show is Run All Night. I think it's the kind of the hidden gem of his filmography in the late action period. It's his best movie with Jaime Colette Serra. The supporting cast, I think, is pretty strong. It's got Ed Harris kind of as his nemesis slash friend slash mentor. It's a very like Tom Hanks and Paul Newman in Road to Perdition type of dynamic, right, which this movie reminded me a lot of when I was rewatching it. And then Common kind of is in the Jude Law part. And Joel Kinnaman is in, like, the Taylor Hecklin, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, part, as the son of Liam Neeson. I think the action's good. It's, like, really well-paced. I think the premise, just because it's Road to Perdition, is in the conflict is interesting. So this is one that I saw in theaters and was, like, really pleasantly surprised by. And luckily, when I went back and watched it this past weekend, I still liked it a lot.
Yeah, this was a first-time watch for me. This and San Andreas were the two, I think, out of our 20 movies that I had never seen. I enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty breathlessly paced, and I like Liam Neeson as kind of tired, sad, old gangster guy. A guy who's, like, kind of down on the roster of tough guys and who everybody's kind of written off for being a fuck up. I liked him a lot. The climax didn't work for me as well, and I can't decide if I like Joel Kinnaman. Sometimes he's like a little too intense for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I've seen him in enough stuff other than Suicide Squad and RoboCop, but I like him more in this than in those two.
Okay. My memory was that I kind of liked him in RoboCop, but then I have to remember that they remade RoboCop, and I try not to do that.
Yeah, it's something that the only reason why I remember RoboCop is because of a running joke when we had the F This Movie Fest for 1987, and somebody asked for a time check, and then I would put up like the gif of RoboCop from 2014.
That's a good joke.
And I kept that going for several years. So.
The original RoboCop, like, I've come to terms with the fact in recent years, is, like, in my top 10 movies of all time. Like,
that's how I feel about Devil's Own. Yeah, cool.
I need that money, Tom.
Yeah. Tom, you're RoboCop. That's fantastic. Let's go shoot Mr. Burke.
So, yeah, I liked Run All Night as kind of, like, a pretty modest little, like, B-movie action programmer, you know. Again, not necessarily, like, heavy on the action, but there's enough of it for me to dig it.
Yeah. The Devil's Own RoboCop.
The Devil's Own RoboCop. My pick for Liam Neeson is possibly my favorite Joe Carnahan movie, although I do love Narc. I know everybody loves The Gray. I like The Gray, but I would any day of the week choose to watch his version of The A-Team over The Gray. And Liam Neeson is part of an ensemble. It's not necessarily like a Liam Neeson movie, so it's kind of a cheat because he's part of an ensemble playing Hannibal. But I love the ensemble in this movie. I even love Quentin Rampage Jackson as B.A. Baracus. He's like a UFC guy who's not primarily an actor, and I don't think has done much acting since, as far as I know. But I love Charlton Copley in it. I love Bradley Cooper in it. I just think there's a line in the movie that is the entire movie's thesis. Liam Neeson at one point says, "Overkill is underrated." And I was like, well, that seems to be the premise from which Joe Carnahan is working in this movie, because it is all overkill. It is big, silly, really, really fun. I watched the show as a kid here and there because I liked Mr. T, but I wasn't like a devotee of the A-Team, and I'm certainly not as an adult. So I don't hold the property with any kind of preciousness. But in terms of the movie adaptation, I really, really, really like it.
So this was one of the few first time watches for me.
Oh, wow.
I just missed it. Yeah. I don't know why, but I don't know. Like, I think this will be like our biggest disagreement of the show. Well, I know it's fine, but I don't know. I like Joe Carnahan. Like, when I like Joe Carnahan, I really like Joe Carnahan. I love The Gray, and I love Smokin' Aces, and Narc is really good too. But the 18 stretch and boss level are just kind of okay for me. Stretch maybe even less than okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. For some reason, like, that I just couldn't get, I was rooting for the wrong people in this movie. I was rooting for Patrick Wilson.
He's really fun.
Because every time he's on screen, he's so much fun.
Yeah.
And like, I like Bradley Cooper, and I thought the stuff with him and Jessica Biel was fun too, but I don't know why. I think it's part of it might just be my Charlton Copley allergy outside of District 9.
Prawns.
And then I couldn't get out of my head with Quentin Jackson just sort of mimicking Mr. T, which I understand that's the point, but and I don't know. And then just Liam Neeson didn't really like have any effect on me in this one. So like, I don't think it's a bad movie or anything like that, but I was hoping that I liked it more considering I'm a fan of Joe Carnahan.
Sure. I still haven't seen Boss Level.
Yeah, I think you're okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'll catch up with it one of these days, but this and Smoke and Aces are kind of like Joe Carnahan's shot at studio action movies. And I really like both of those movies. I wish he had been given more chances to make studio action movies. We didn't get his Mission Impossible 3. We didn't get his Bad Boys 3. You know, we came close on both. And it bums me out, especially when I watch something like this. And I really think there's so much joy of filmmaking, joy of the action genre, joy of going as big as he possibly can and just staging a lot of chaos. I just find it so charming. And I think the cast, I think it's exceptionally well cast, and everybody seems to be having a really, really good time. Nobody more so than Patrick Wilson, as you pointed out.
Yeah. He's a really fun bad guy. Joe Carnahan is also one of my favorite talking heads in the documentary Out of Print about the New Beverly Theater. that he, anytime he shows up, he always says something like that makes me like Joe Carnahan even more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good pick.
Thanks. Thank you. All right. My next pick, I will go with Denzel Washington. And my pick for Denzel is Ricochet, which I realized after I watched it, I should have picked a different movie. Not because I don't like Ricochet, but there's a sort of underrated Denzel Washington movie. Well, I'll just say what it is. Book of Eli. That I like a little bit more. But Ricochet is from 1991, directed by the great Russell Mulcahy, and written by, or at least story credit, goes to Fred Decker. He plays a cop who takes down John Lithgow's psychopath, gets very famous for it, eventually becomes the district attorney, and John Lithgow escapes jail to fuck with his life and make him pay. And it's got the great, like, Joel Silver quality to it. Mary Ellen Trainer, of course, shows up in a major role because it's, I believe, a Joel Silver production. If it's not, it might as well be. Lithgow is out of his mind, like, over the top in terms of, you know, Lithgow's a good actor, but needs somebody to maybe rein him in. And Russell Mulcahy was not the guy to do that. So Lithgow is really, really, really going for it. But I would say he's almost matched by a young and hungry Denzel Washington, who is really over the top as well. Not afraid to go big in this movie. My favorite performance is probably Ice-T as Odessa, which was the reason I think I wanted to see this movie in 1991, because it came out the same year as New Jack City, and I was all in on Ice-T as an actor. But yeah, Ricochet is sleazy and violent and nonsensical and really, really entertaining and fun.
Yeah, I get a kick out of Denzel Washington out of control performances, and this is by far probably his most out of control one.
Totally, yeah. And
he's definitely trying to like match Lithgow at his level, which is just fantastic. This movie, like, even by crazy action movie standards, this movie's, like, certifiable. Like, it's, like, I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, like Lithgow just has, like, this fanboy walking around with him, and it's played by, like, Ally McGraw and Robert Evans' son. And it's like if Lithgow was Jack Slater and, like, this guy is Austin O'Brien. It's crazy. Like, this movie would be a perfect double feature with The Last Boy Scout.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's like The Last Boy Scout with a venereal disease.
Yes, absolutely.
It's just like this action movie that's foaming at the mouth. I really, really like Ricochet a lot. It's not a movie I grew up with. I just saw it recently. God, maybe it was on HBO Max like a year ago, and I finally, like, I remember tweeting that night. I'm like, I'm going to watch Ricochet for the first time. And then, like, I got so many replies to that. So I was just like, wow, people really like Ricochet. And then I watched it. I was just like, oh, my God, now I know why.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a great pick.
I mean, there's a whole sequence of John Lithgow and Jesse Ventura playing, like, prison gladiators trying to kill each other using phone book armor. It's wild. It's a wild movie. Kevin Pollak playing one of his many partner roles.
Yes.
R.I.P. Kevin Pollak. The character, not the actor. Yeah, he's very much alive. No, Kevin Pollak is alive.
Yeah, okay, good.
His character, spoilers, doesn't make it to the end of the movie.
No, he does not.
What is your Denzel pick?
My Denzel pick is a movie that I was surprised that I liked when I saw it in theaters, and I still like it when I revisited the movie this past weekend. It's The Equalizer 2, which was even more surprising for me because I did not like the first Equalizer at all. I thought it was like an NBC drama pilot mixed with Home Alone. And this one, Equalizer 2, is like This Is Us mixed with the best movie of the year. there's more like interpersonal scenes with Denzel Washington. I think like his dynamic with like Ashton Sanders from Moonlight as kind of like the kid that he's mentoring is really fun. And the bad guy performance, I guess this is a spoiler, but is Pablo Pascal. And it's like there's some really great dick measuring contest scenes in this movie, where like Denzel Washington is just like, oh yeah, you think you're tough? Well, I'm gonna just like go crazy on you and show you what a little cowering like kid you are. Or like when he confronts his old team, who are the villains of the movie. It's just, he's just like, yeah, I'm going to kill you. And then I'm going to, but first I'm going to catch a ride with you and with your wife and your kids to your train station. And it's just like, there's so many little scenes like that. And then the end of the movie is like a mixture of like a disaster movie with like a hurricane and also an action sequence. It's really fun. When it gets violent, it gets like pretty brutally violent. It's like people getting like knives shoved into the back of their necks, and then like he's just digging in there for a few seconds. I mean, but I'm a fan of the movie. The one thing that I am curious about, and if I ever had the opportunity to ask either one of them, I would ask them this. This is the second movie that Melissa Leo has been in, directed by Antoine Fuqua, where she just gets the ever living shit kicked out of her.
Yeah, what is that about?
And I'm wondering if she just likes to do stunts or what.
It's about respecting the work. I forget the first part of it was. Her insane acceptance speech.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That makes me especially like her performance in The Fighter. Nope. Anyway. but like in Olympus Has Fallen, she gets her crap kicked out of her too. And I'm just like, what's going on with that? But I'm a big fan of The Equalizer too.
I'm always rooting for Antoine Fuqua, and he never quite makes the movie that I'm hoping. Yeah, I mean,
he's got some good ones.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like some of his movies, and I think that's why I'm always rooting for him, because he does have some good ones. But then he has just as many where I'm like, oh, you're halfway there, you know. I do like Equalizer 2 better than The Equalizer. I feel like the movie just gets too big by the end when we're dealing with like CG hurricanes. I'm way more into the sequence, and I think I texted you about this, like where Denzel goes up to the apartment of like those douchey boiler room guys who were abused a woman basically and kind of takes revenge for her benefit. I could watch a whole movie of just that, of him just fucking up people for doing wrongs, you know, like once it gets more into the plot and the Pedro Pascal stuff where he becomes a genie and takes everyone's wishes and Denzel has to bring him down. I was less into some of that stuff. I just think it overreaches by the end. Yeah. And that's the Antoine Fuqua of it all, where it's like, oh, I like a lot of this, but you don't quite get there. What are the best Antoine Fuqua movies? Let's look it up. I mean, Training Day, obviously.
So, Training Day, Equalizer 2, and I'm a Brooklyn's Finest guy.
I like Brooklyn's Finest. I would probably need to watch it again, but I remember seeing it and liking it. I mean, Replacement Killers, I think, is okay.
I haven't seen that one or Tears of the Sun.
I've never seen Tears of the Sun. I didn't like... I'm not crazy about Bait. I'm not crazy about King Arthur. I'm not crazy about Shooter. I'm not crazy about Olympus Has Fallen. Never saw Southpaw. I like his Magnificent Seven remake enough.
I like the three that I mentioned. Bait, I thought was okay, but
it's okay.
In like 20 years.
Right.
King Arthur I liked more than most people. I thought Shooter sucked. Olympus Has Fallen is not my bag. Southpaw was really disappointing. I'm not the biggest Magnificent Seven guy. His next movie's got Mark Wahlberg, so got that to look forward to.
A Shooter reunion.
Yeah. And his next movie after that's got Gyllenhaal, Ethan Hawke, Peter Sarsgaard, Riley Keough, so that looks a little bit better.
Do I get to be the shooter again? Who do you want me to shoot, Antoine? Who do you want me to shoot? I'll shoot him, bro.
You want me to shoot Ryan Phillippe because he did the Shoot a TV show?
USA, characters welcome. Characters welcome, bro.
Did you know that my new show on HBO Max is called Wall Street, but it's spelled W-H-A-O? W-A-H-O?
Greed is good, bro.
Yeah.
You hear me?
You want to meet my entourage?
You could be the turtle. Come on, bro.
Did you know that? Did you know that Turtle is behind the entire DTV empire of Bruce Willis?
Jerry Ferrara, bro. He produced all that shit.
Yep. Yeah. Good time. I do like, I don't know why I think this, but I feel like Antoine Fuqua is like the landing pad for Denzel because he doesn't have Tony Scott anymore.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Like, he needs to get these action movies out of his system.
Right.
And he needs to trust somebody, and he's like, okay, Fuqua.
I think you should add replacement killers to your list of Into the Blue. And what was the other one?
Firewall, which I've seen, but right. I've never seen Firewall enough times.
I think you would like replacement killers enough in a 90s kind of way.
It is added.
All right, good.
Okay.
I think it's one of the better Fuquas.
Yes, yes. All right, my next pick is Mila Jovovich.
Ooh, very good.
Yeah. So I think my underrated pick for Mila Jovovich is the worst movie of the 20.
I agree with that.
And it's not even good, but I forgot that it was bad, so I picked Resident Evil Apocalypse, which was the second and last Resident Evil movie I've seen. And I saw it in theaters opening night, and I remember thinking it was really fun and laughing a lot at Mike Epps saying GTA motherfucker and running over a zombie, which when I watched it this time, I'm like, that's stupid. And I thought Nemesis was really fun, and like the zombie monster guy that like is the main bad guy of the zombie monsters. I was wrong. He's lame.
Turns out it's just Eric. What's his name? Mabius.
Yeah.
The crow.
Mabius is
the crow.
Mabius is Nemesis. Nemesis is Mabius.
We're through the looking gas, bro.
I think you need a shooter.
Who do you want me to shoot?
Nabius?
Yo, you watch Burn Notice, bro? Characters welcome. Wahlberg just shilling for the USA Network.
Hey, sandwich me in front of a couple NCIS rooms.
I'll watch some Royal Pains. Come on, bro.
Necessary Roughness? That was a show, but it wasn't about football? Or was it? Characters welcome? FX got the movies? Question mark? So, yeah, Resident Evil Apocalypse reminded me a lot of, like, Survival of the Dead this time. But if it wasn't...
Survival of the Dead is a way better movie.
I didn't finish. It reminded me of Survival of the Dead if it was made by a person who's never seen a movie.
All right, I'll accept that.
And it was directed by Alexander Witt. I always thought this was a Paul W.S. Anderson, but no. He left for a couple movies Resident Evil franchise.
He wrote it, though,
and Alexander Witt was the cinematographer for Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl.
Which is surprising, because that movie looks great, and this movie looks like dog shit.
Yeah, this movie looks like it was shoved inside of Screen Gems and then spat out the other end.
100%. I don't think I've seen all the Resident Evil movies. Like, I've seen several of them, because I keep trying to plow through all of them, and I've yet to make it to the end. But of the ones that I've seen, this one is definitely my least favorite. The last time I tried to get through the series, I remember getting to part 3 and being like, wow, this is such an improvement in quality. And that's because it's directed by Ricochet's Russell Mulcahy. But yeah, it turns out you need Paul W.S. Anderson in your Resident Evil franchise, because this movie is not good.
No.
I like Mila Jovovich. I like watching her kick some ass. She seems to be having a decent enough time in this movie when she's not playing like tortured memory, and where it all lands, I can't even say. I've never played the game. I have no interest in the game. So if there are connections, like the other female lead in this movie.
Yeah, that's from the game.
It's from the game, right.
From what I read, this is like the favorite of the fans of the video game franchise because it's got the most characters carried over and like the most like canon that they brought in with like Raccoon City and stuff like that.
And I guess I could just give a shit about any of that. Right. So it made me miss other Resident Evil movies, which is hard to do.
Yeah. I will say this, and this goes for your pick too, which I won't spoil, but I've missed a lot of Mila Jovovich's action movies outside of like The Fifth Element or Cuffs and things like that, which I should have picked. I should have picked Cuffs. And I don't mean this in like a guy thinking a woman's hot way. I think that she looks so great as an action hero.
Yeah.
That kind of makes up for how bad a lot of these movies are. Like, because even in your pick too, I was like, the whole time I was just like, man, she is just committed and watchable and interesting to look at. And I think that like really kind of helps drag the movie to whatever success it has in the case of Resident Evil Apocalypse.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
My pick is a Paul W.S. Anderson joint, and that is Monster Hunter from last year, which, to be fair, I picked without seeing because I was like, well, I heard it was good, and I can't pick Fifth Element because that's certainly not underrated, and I can't pick Ultraviolet because it's garbage, so, and I didn't want to pick another Resident Evil movie if you were already like representing that franchise, so I didn't really know what to pick. So I went with Monster Hunter and rented it from the Redbox and was pleasantly surprised by it, so I kept it as my pick. It's, you know, unfortunate that Tony Jaa's only appearance on this heavy action show will be as the second lead in the Mila Jovovich movie, but here we are.
He's in another one.
Oh, he is? Okay.
Yep.
I can't remember, but...
one of my picks. Okay. Later. Yep.
I liked all the stuff. I didn't love the movie. I liked it enough. I thought it was charming. I liked all the stuff with her and Tony Jaa, just like having to coexist and fight monsters together. It was almost like Enemy Mine for a big chunk of it, where it's like they have to, they can't communicate. They don't speak the same language. But they become friends and they start fighting monsters together. I liked all that stuff. I'm less crazy about the kind of world buildy stuff at the beginning and the end of the movie. Which very much exists to establish a franchise or set up a sequel. And I just could give a shit about any of that. But that middle section, I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I was really surprised by it, too. It was a movie that I really wanted to see just because it was like the one movie that was in theaters last year that wasn't on VOD.
Yes.
So it was like forbidden fruit. For some and I finally caught up to it for this show, and... yeah, I was really, I thought it was really fun. And I agree with you, like the first 30 minutes or so where it was like the world building stuff with Ron Perlman and like the portal, like pirate ship and everything. And then like T.I. and Megan Good are like Starship Troopers. I was like, whatever, I'm not into any of this. Yeah. But then, once she kind of hooks up with Tony Jaa and they start fighting monsters together and just kind of having like a buddy movie, I thought it was fun. And at that point, it just like, I just kind of got caught up in the movie and I really found it enjoyable. And then by the end of it, when they brought back the world buildy stuff, I was like as on board for sequels as I was with like Alita Battle Angel. I was like, yes, more Monster Hunter. I thought the monsters were like, there weren't too many of them, and it wasn't like Pacific Rim where it was like action overkill. I like that they would have a move, and then there'd be like 3 seconds for you to appreciate the move, and
right,
then there'd
right.
be another move, everything right. like that. So the action was kind of like cleaner in that sense. So coming from Paul W.S. Anderson, who I had pretty much written off since, you know, Resident Evil at the beginning of the 2000s, I was pleasantly surprised and almost tricked into thinking I need to go back and watch some of his Resident Evil movies with Mila Jovovich that came later.
Yeah, one of these days I'll do that. I'll actually get through the entire franchise. Because, again, she's great and she's so committed. And not to once again get into this, like, what I wish the movie was versus what it is, but, like, to have her just be this Earth soldier who's magically transported to Monster Planet. Like, I don't need any of that. Just open the movie where she's living on Monster Planet and having to fight monsters. I'm great with that. Because that's where I think she really excels. All the table setting I just thought was completely unnecessary, but she's great in action movies, and I wish that she would make some more. I'm really glad you picked her as one of our 10, because we should have more women on these lists, you know, and unfortunately there aren't a lot of female action stars.
Yeah, we were thinking of, like, Angelina Jolie, and unfortunately, like, the one that I would love to feature, but, like, she's only in, like, a handful of them is Gina Davis. Right. And I don't think those are necessarily underrated. A lot of people are fans of those, but.
Right. Cause we're, one of us is doing Long Kiss Goodnight and one of us is doing Cutthroat Island. Right. I mean,
right. Yeah.
And Angelina Jolie, like, one of us has to do Salt. No, thank you.
Yeah. I think we'd be fighting each other over, like, Wanted or a Tomb Raider.
I'm not ready to fight for Wanted.
Yeah, I'm not really either. I'm ready to fight for Monster Hunter, and that's why we picked Mila Jovovich.
That's right.
Yeah.
Is it my turn? Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Okay, I will go Christian Slater. And for Christian Slater, I picked Hard Rain from, like, 98?
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah, because I remember watching this when I got my appendix out, which happened in 98. I watched it on VHS. And it's a Graham Yost screenplay, which I didn't realize until this most recent rewatch. And he wrote Speed and was responsible for creating Justified, which is a really great show that Mark Wahlberg was not on because it was on FX. yeah, it's just, you know, it was originally called The Flood, which is a terrible title, but tells you what the movie is. And this is, like, much more my speed in terms of disaster movie, because it's part disaster movie, part Western, part action movie. And I don't think it fully succeeds at any of the three. I think it's, like, a movie that's, like, 75% of the way there. And it's really close to being this, like, underappreciated gem. I don't think it totally gets there, but I really enjoy it. Morgan Freeman is kind of the bad guy, but then isn't really, because ultimately he and Christian Slater kind of team up. And Morgan Freeman, I think, does a good job of playing a guy who genuinely really was just there for the money and didn't want to hurt anybody. Christian Slater and Minnie Driver have, like, two scenes together, and I so wish they had more, because their two scenes together are really great and I think would have added to the charm in that way that, like, that Keanu and Sandra Bullock chemistry from Speed and The Lake House, obviously. I love their two scenes together, and I wish that they had more, because it also would have made more sense. You know, there's a certain point where Christian Slater is risking his life to go after Minnie Driver. And on the one hand, I get it. But on the other hand, it's like, you haven't really established this as a relationship that he's going to fight for and all these things, whatever. But it seems like a miserable movie to have made, because,
oh my God, yes.
It's, you know, if San Andreas is a green screen CGI movie, this is all practical water and everybody is up to their waist, their necks, their chins, the entire movie. Everybody is soaking wet. Just seems miserable to watch, but it's, or it seems miserable to make, but it's cool to watch, I thought.
Yeah, I that's the main note that I put down, is just, like, everybody must have been miserable filming this.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I walked through a puddle at Navy Pier with Rob and Eric, and I've been complaining to Eric, whose idea it was to walk through that puddle, for 3 years. And, like, then there's Hard Rain. But yeah, I watched this for the first time about a year ago. Rob and I wrote about it, and we were both not fans of it. And then I was surprised you picked it, but I was also encouraged because I was like, oh, maybe I'll watch it kind of through Patrick's eyes this time. So I was a little bit kinder to it maybe than I was last time. And I found more that I liked about it. I still kind of have some complaints about some of the supporting characters because it's like one on the sheriff's side and then one on Morgan Freeman's side where they're just complete morons. Oh, yeah. And it's like they're written as such just to aggravate you. And it works swimmingly, no pun intended. I just like Christian Slater brings like a really cool, like everyman quality to his action performances. And he's very likable in these types of movies. And it's cool how they sort of mix like a disaster movie with a heist movie with, as you said, a Western. And I didn't give it as much credit before as I should have. It's got a good end credit song by Jars of Clay.
Oh my gosh. Called Flood, right? It's like they spent 2 seconds thinking about that.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a good choice.
Well, thanks. Amazon. Oh, it is? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I have the Blu-ray, which I think is out of print.
Look at you.
Yeah, yeah. Not to brag or anything, but I got my OOPHR.
Woo!
What is your Christian Slater pick?
My pick is Mobsters from 1991. I didn't grow up with Mobsters. I saw it maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. And instantly fell in love with it. It's the ultra-violent Dick Tracy Young Guns hybrid I never knew I wanted. There's more entertainment per minute in Mobsters than any other movie in the 20th century. Something's always happening. It's maybe more pro-gangster than even Gotti, which I didn't think was possible. Because it's all about, like, these guys did it their way, and it was fucking awesome. And if that's the thesis of your movie, yeah, go for it completely. And that's what Mobsters does. It's got one of the best line deliveries of all time with F. Murray Abraham just going, you know what the secret to America is? Money! And the way that it's shot is like, it's like a crane shot where it like zooms in on him and he's just like, money! It's phenomenal. I don't know what else to say about Mobsters other than it's just like, it's just like so silly and not a gangster movie with any gravitas whatsoever. And that's sort of refreshing because you're used to seeing like a Coppola Scorsese level, even a Barry Levinson and Bugsy type of level movie. And this is much more akin to like Gangster Squad, but a great version of that.
Yeah, I saw it in 91 and loved it because I didn't know any better. I was a kid and I loved Christian Slater and I loved Richard Grieco and I loved Patrick Dempsey. And those were my actors because I was a child, right? And they were like teen stars. And so at the time, it didn't make sense to me that all the critics hated it. And now I understand that they were just like, look at these children trying to play grown up in this. This is a grown up's genre. And how dare they muddy it with their teen starness? Divorced from all of that years later, you know, again, Mobsters is just so entertaining and like shouldn't look as good as it does. It has great cinematography. It has amazing production design. Like they spent some money on this and they maybe shouldn't have, you know, but they did. And like, it's better for it, obviously. You have the four like young leads, but then you have people like F. Murray Abraham and you have people like Michael Gambon, right? And you have Anthony Quinn. And, like, you have got some heavy hitters. And Christian Slater, you know, digging in for all it's worth and trying to prove himself as a grown-up actor. Not everybody is great in the movie, but that just adds to the charm. No, I'm a huge fan of this movie. I rewatched it on cable, like, a year ago. And I was like, man, this movie hasn't lost a beat.
Yeah, it's like the bratty little brother of the Untouchables.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was also super happy to see Chris Penn show up. I've missed Chris Penn in movies.
I remember going to see this. I saw this and Hot Shots, both opening day. And walking into the theater, and it was the sauna scene with Christian Slater and Chris Penn. And mm-hmm. sitting down and watching that scene for like 5 minutes and realizing, oh, I'm in the wrong showing. I miscounted the hours between Hot Shots and Mobsters. My showing of Mobsters doesn't start for like another 90 minutes. So me and my friend went out and sat in the lobby of Woodfield 3 and 4 for an hour and a half waiting for our screening of Mobsters to start.
It's a good use of time because, yeah, participation for Mobsters is the only thing as good as Mobsters.
It was worth it.
Woo! Yeah, yeah. I love Mobsters. It's a great movie. Summer of 91, man, there are some good action movies that year.
It, for me, maybe the best year for action movies ever. Like, it's bananas.
Yeah. Even the throwaways are great.
Yep.
Yep. All right, so my pick, I'm going to go with Tom Cruise.
Oh, boy. All right.
Why, oh, boy?
I don't know, because, again, I forgot that we had him on here. Like,
okay. So, my pick is Mission Impossible 3, which was a movie that I saw like once or twice, but then in my memory thought that it was like super underrated and unnecessarily shat upon by fans of the later Mission Impossible movies. The thing I always kind of stumped for with this movie is that it humanizes Ethan Hunt. And I always argued that if you didn't have this movie, the other three after it wouldn't work as well because you finally know who Ethan Hunt is as a person, whereas in the Brian De Palma one, he was kind of like an action piece to move around. And in Mission Impossible 2, he was a guy that you didn't like because he was weird and had long hair.
Well, he was more mountain climber than anything else in that movie.
Yeah. Rewatching Mission Impossible 3, having seen a lot more Ortsy, Kurtzman, J.J. Abrams stuff since then, I really had no patience for all the rabbit's foot, MacGuffin crap, or mystery box bullshit. However, I will say that the humanizing of Ethan Hunt still works for me. I think that Philip Seymour Hoffman is giving a fun movie star villain performance, and I'll give it this compliment. I think it's the most adorable of all the Mission Impossible movies.
There's a ton of good stuff in Mission Impossible 3, and I think its characterization as being underrated is still fair, because I remember even at the time that it came out, people were writing it off as like made for TV because J.J. Abrams had come out of Alias, and that was their diss. Like, he's not ready to direct feature films, and now he's making Star Wars movies, you know. But I think there's a ton of good stuff. Like you said, Philip Seymour Hoffman is great. I think all that Carrie Russell stuff works and haunts my dreams.
Because of the
wonky eye.
Yeah.
God, it's so upsetting.
Pretty gross.
Yeah. This is where they really kind of establish the team aspect that would carry forward, which is like one of the things that I love about the franchise. So there's a lot of stuff I think that gets established here that, like you said, is what works in a lot of the follow-ups. So without this one, I don't think we get, you know, Ghost Protocol or Rogue Nation or the other one, Fallout, in the same way, you know, because again, Tom Cruise had been like sort of the lone action star of the first two movies, and this one follows much more the team dynamic. The team gets dropped. You know, we don't get more Maggie Q or Jonathan Rhys Meyers, half of which I'm okay with in subsequent movies. But we do get Simon Pegg, you know, which is great.
Lawrence Fishburne, I think, was in one or two after this, wasn't he?
I don't remember him being in any other ones because I thought he got replaced by Alec Baldwin.
I will check.
You could be right.
I want, what's his face? Emilio Estevez to come back in Mission Impossible 7 and be like, no, it just broke my glasses. I'm fine.
R.I.P. Emilio Estevez.
Yeah. Yeah. He got it good.
He sure did. And again, as a kid, like, that meant nothing to me. Not that I was a kid. I was probably in high school or something. But like, having never watched the show, I didn't understand the way that the De Palma Mission Impossible was like spitting in the face of everybody who ever watched that show by killing off the entire team and making Jim Phelps the bad guy.
Yeah, you are right. Mission Impossible 3 is the only one that Fishburne was in.
But yeah, no, I like Mission Impossible 3. I think it's a fun one.
I also, back when this also, I think, kind of got knocked because it was like when it was people shitting on Tom Cruise because of the Katie Holmes thing.
Oh, sure.
And like how frantically and maniacally in love he was. But I like that in the movie Mission Impossible 3. I think because it's like, yeah, Cruise is going to love you hard. If you're in love with Cruise, he's going to love you with every fiber of the universe.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I think, yeah, this is the most adorable one. It's got a lot of heart too.
Yeah.
Yep.
My pick for Tom Cruise is Jack Reacher, which is his first collaboration really with Christopher McQuarrie, which would of course pay off in subsequent Mission Impossible sequels. So it all connects. And Jack Reacher, again, barely an action movie. You know, there's like a fight in the street. There's a car chase. There's a shootout at the end, but a lot of the movie is just people talking, but it's pretty awesome. And again, I say this as somebody who's never read the Lee Child's books. I know that Tom Cruise is miscast. I remember people talking about that at the time that the movie came out. I thought the marketing for the movie was bad and went and saw it, and it was a really pleasant surprise. It's really smartly written. It's really well acted. You have Werner Herzog playing a villain. You have Jai Courtney actually being like...
Interesting.
Yeah, like, I don't mind Jai Courtney in this movie, you know? Yeah. Rosamund Pike, who's a little hit or miss for me. I kind of like her in this movie, but maybe could have been played by almost anyone, you know, and that's no knock against her. But Tom Cruise, I think, is doing some really cool stuff. And again, playing into that Tom Cruise mythos of awesomeness. It's just a really, really solid movie.
Yeah, I've always been a really big fan of this one. I hadn't seen it since theaters until I watched it a couple weeks ago. And yeah, I mean, it's just a good mystery first. And I think the Jack Reacher character as played by Tom Cruise is like, he's sort of like, there was one other character I was talking about earlier and I totally am blanking on it. I think it was maybe Denzel Washington in The Equalizer, or I can't remember, but I said somebody was kind of like edgy, or no, it was The Rock in Walking Tall.
Okay.
Tom Cruise and Jack Reacher is kind of edgy, and I think the movie is a little bit darker than this type of movie usually is.
Yeah.
So the movie kind of feels a little dangerous in that way. And there's just some great stuff in it. Like, I love the fight that he has with Jai Courtney in the street, and like how quickly he dispatches them. You think that it's going to be like this big, you know, Jackie Chan Legend of the Drunken Master brawl, but it's just like, no, when he gets him, he finishes him. And I appreciate the fact that the movie sort of, oh God, I lost my train of thought, but like, watch Jack Reacher twice, don't watch Jack Reacher 2.
I still haven't seen Jack Reacher 2, which is weird because, A, it's a Tom Cruise movie that I haven't seen, and it may be the only Tom Cruise movie I haven't seen. And B, I liked the first one so much that for me to have skipped the sequel just based on the reviews is a little bit out of character for me. But I know you said it's bad.
Yeah. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. So it's like, I love the part of when he, so one of the things I like about the movie is like, just as much as he's Ethan Hunt in this movie, he's also like the lawyer from A Few Good Men, like trying to work things out and investigate this whole thing. And there's one part towards the end of the movie where he's just like, he's like, the thing that I couldn't get my head around because it was so fucking weird was the quarter and the machine. And he's just like, even for a crazy person, that's fucking crazy. And I just love his delivery of that line. Jack Reacher is definitely a USA movie. Characters welcome.
Hey. Yo, Donnie. Jack Reacher's son.
I could be Reacher. I could be Jack Reacher around because I get the girls.
Jack Reacher shadow recruit.
I shook Poppy's hand.
It started the partnership between Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie, and for that we should be grateful.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I like the two of them working together.
I like that. Oh, no, they did Valkyrie together, didn't they?
Oh, I forgot about Valkyrie. There's two Tom Cruise movies I haven't seen. Because he wrote Valkyrie. He didn't direct it, right? That was a Brian Singer.
No, that was a Brian Singer. Yeah, Valkyrie I remember being pretty good, but yeah, definitely R.I.P. Brian Singer. Yikes. Yeah. All right, so it's your turn.
My turn, I'm going to go with my boy, Nicolas Cage. And this was a hard one for me because he's got a lot of big action movies that people are familiar with. And then when you get into what do you consider an underrated action movie from Nicolas Cage, it's like, well, you're talking about DTV stuff, and that's real hit or miss. So I went with one called Rage. I'm looking up the year that it came out. I'm sorry, it's 2014. Directed by Paco Cabezas and written by Jim Agnew and Sean Keller, who are actually people that Sean Keller I actually kind of know, and that's not why I picked this, and I'm not name dropping, but I didn't know that he had written it until after I saw it and I posted something on Twitter about it. This was, you know, 2 years ago or something when I was doing my Nicolas Cage rewatch. And he singled it out. He was like, what'd you think of that one? And I said, what I thought of it. And then saw on IMDb that he had written it. And I was like, oh, shit, I hope I said this. I hope I didn't say anything bad about it. Anyway, Nicolas Cage plays like a former gangster, kind of a Tony Soprano type, who has gone legit. And then his daughter goes missing and turns up dead. And he decides to get revenge. He and his Irish buddies. So that's catnip for you. Mm-hmm. Again, is it a great movie? No. Is it a decent Nick Cage action movie? Yeah. It's got some good scenes. I think he's really good in it, you know, and that's not always necessarily the case in his DTV stuff, especially in his DTV action stuff. But it was hard to find a movie for this slot. To be honest, and this one kind of jumped out at me as being, I think, one of the less respected, but I think one of the better DTV offerings.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of his DTV movies other than the five that I watched for the Face Off episode that we did together. Yeah. But I thought this one was good. I had fun with it. Once I saw kind of where it was leading and then thought, oh, this is Mystic River.
Yeah.
It was like when Chaz Palminteri figures everything out at the end of The Usual Suspects, where I was finding all these one-to-ones after that. And that almost made it more fun for me. So I had a good time with it. I think that, as you said, Nicolas Cage is good in it. I think for a direct-to-video action movie, some of the action sequences are pretty well done.
Yeah.
Especially there's like a car chase kind of in the middle, that I thought was really solid. And, one of his buddies was the pimp in Kiss of the Dragon. So it was kind of cool seeing him in another movie.
Oh, I was very like, nice.
That guy looks like a guy that I know from a movie. It's just funny to me sometimes when I see these DTV movies, because I'm like, oh, they clearly got Danny Glover for 2 days,
right?
Because it's just they need the name on the video box, mm-hmm. And then they don't need him for a long time. But I appreciate that Cage puts in a lot more effort and care into these movies than, you know, a John Cusack or a Bruce Willis. So I'll always give one of his direct to video or VOD offerings a chance.
Yeah. All right. Cool. What was your Nick Cage pick?
Mine is Jiu-Jitsu from last year. This is kind of like catnip for me in the sense that it's like if you just put Predator in Mortal Kombat. And
for some reason, I thought you picked a different one, so that's why Tony Jaa shows up again. Okay.
Oh, what do you think I picked?
National Treasure.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that in a long time, so I will put it on my list.
Well, I didn't rewatch it because I had just watched it with the kids maybe 8 months ago. So I was like, I got that one in the bag. Good thing.
So,
anyway.
Anyways, but you saw Jiu-Jitsu, didn't you?
I did see Jiu-Jitsu, yeah, not too long ago.
Yeah. Okay, so I like that Nicolas Cage is basically playing Christopher Lambert in Lambert in Mortal Kombat. He's a blast in this movie.
Oh my gosh, yes, he is.
And I think the action in this movie, which is, you know, it's when you watch jiu-jitsu, that's why you're there. You're there to watch the action. And I think it's shot really well. There's some like really weird choices that they make. Like it turns into Hardcore Henry with like a running on a rooftop.
Yes, it does.
With Tony Jaa. It turns into a Spike Lee movie with like Predator shooting boomerangs at Eddie Steeples from My Name is Earl. Like it just makes choices because just to make choices, which I'm fine with in a movie like Jiu-Jitsu. There's a running gag with like Eddie Steeples misinterpreting what this one villager woman is saying. And it's not funny at first, but it goes on for so long that it becomes like a Family Guy joke that it ends up being really funny by the end, because it's just basically the gag from Ghost Dog where like, or actually it's like right. The reverse of it, where it's like everything she's saying, he's getting just a little bit wrong.
Right.
But yeah, I think, you know, it's a fun movie. I think it could have used a little bit more Nicolas Cage. He's very much like the and credit in this movie, because the lead in it is, I don't even remember his name. It's like Alain Moussy.
He's like a French guy, right?
Yeah. Not a lot of heat there.
No, he's like, I think he's like a Alain Moussy. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like a stunt guy and has a few acting credits. I haven't seen a ton of stuff that he's acted in. Obviously, I've seen a lot of his stunt work. But, yeah, not the most compelling screen presence, I would say.
He quits himself well in the action scenes, but there's a lot of scenes where he's not doing that, and you're just like, mm.
And I used to be a lot more high on Frank Grillo until I heard stories about him not being the nicest guy. And now I'm not really excited to see him show up in a movie, and he makes a lot of movies. So Nicolas Cage was obviously my favorite part of this, not just because it's Nicolas Cage, but because he just seems to be entertaining himself so much. And I think I pointed this out in my review, but there's a scene where he shows off this paper hat that he made that I just have to believe was a Nicolas Cage ad lib and not in the script. And it just made me love it that much more that he's like, I've got this idea. What if I make a paper hat? And I just loved it. Oh, thanks.
I will say this for National Treasure, since you brought it up. That was one of the two movies that I saw with a friend where they turned to me and said that a character in that movie is basically me, which is Justin Bartha.
Oh, you know, you don't want to be the Bartha character.
Somebody told me I was Bartha, and then somebody told me, and this is the hardest I laughed during Bridesmaids, somebody said, I think you're just a guy version of Kristen Wiig in Bridesmaids. And I was like, Mike, that is actually 100% accurate.
I do not associate you with Bartha in any movie.
Thank you. I appreciate
that.
Yeah. Not even The Hangover, because you left me on the roof.
I forgot he was like the fourth guy in The Hangover.
Yeah.
The Hangover trilogy. Sorry.
How did we let it get that far?
Right. Got me. My favorite story about National Treasure didn't happen to me. It happened to Mike Pomero, where he was sitting in a theater and there were two women in front of him. That he was not at National Treasure, but it was when National Treasure was out. And these two women in front of him were talking about it. And one of the women described it as, it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark, but better, because it could actually happen. And that's my favorite review of National Treasure.
That's, I don't see anything wrong with that. That's amazing. Oh, real quick, better Irish accent, Brad Pitt in The Devil's Own or Richard Gere in The Jackal?
Oof. I haven't seen The Jackal in a long time. I definitely saw it when it came out and bought it on Laserdisc. Don't ask me why.
Did you get a job to get the discount by The Jackal and then quit?
I don't think I did. maybe it was for Matilda May from Life Force. It was my residual love for Matilda May. Gosh, I want to say Gears is better, but I might be wrong about that.
Yeah.
God, all the right. Jackal is not good.
No, it wasn't.
And I've never seen Day of the Jackal, so I'm not comparing it to the original.
It created the biggest remake crime, which is it's so bad that it makes you not want to watch the better original.
Right.
Version. Yeah. All right. So my next pick, my last pick,
is there one more
Vin
after
Diesel.
This? Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. I know who that is.
It's my last pick, but then you have a pick after that. I'm picking Vin Diesel.
All right. Nice.
And my choice is Riddick from 2013. So I love Pitch Black, and I really love Riddick. And I've only seen Chronicles of Riddick once, and I think I would like it more now. But I know you're a big fan of Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah, I would have picked it if you weren't picking Riddick. I didn't want us both to pick two movies from the Pitch Black universe.
Yeah. I could watch like 100 Riddick movies. Like if they had like a Truman Show just of Riddick doing stuff, I would watch it. I love, especially in Riddick, because the budget is decreased. It's very lo-fi. It's very like analog 80s special effects. The opening act of the movie is really cool because it's just this silent movie of Riddick just kind of like inhabiting this alien planet and like trying to get around all these creatures and like crafting weapons and training like a coyote dog and
a CGI coyote dog.
CGI coyote dog. And then in the second half of the movie, it just turns into this like Assault on Precinct 13 type of thing with Jordy Mola and Dave Bautista and Katie Sackhoff and a criminally underused Bokeem Woodbine. And I really have a lot of fun with it. I thought Pitch Black, when I revisited the movie for Scary Movie Month a couple years ago, was even better than I remembered. I just think that of the times where Vin Diesel's trying to be cool, he's the most convincing is Riddick.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I love the Fast and the Furious franchise, but I'm with you in that I wish Riddick was as popular as Dominic Toretto, because I wish we had more, as many Riddick movies as we have Fast and Furious movies. Riddick rules. I haven't watched Pitch Black in a long time, so I don't know how it holds up.
In it.
I know it does. You know, I know Indy's Rada. I haven't seen it in a number of years, so I don't know how it holds up. I know Arrow just put it out on Blu-ray and 4K. I still don't have a 4K player, so I had no reason to upgrade it. But Riddick is great, and when all the mercenaries show up, it's really, really cool. I love the cast. And like you, all that shit at the beginning, like the silent film, where it's just like this almost samurai film of just him and this dog on this alien planet, is really, really compelling stuff. It's an awesome movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was my introduction to Katie Sackhoff, because I was not a Battlestar Galactica guy. So I was like, who is that? And then I realized like everybody knew who that was.
Yeah, she's great. She should have more. She should be an action star, you know, and she's not. But between Battlestar Galactica and her role in Riddick, I kind of wish she had more action movie roles. I know she was one of those names floated around when there were going to be like multiple female Expendables movies. She was one of the names that always got tossed out. That obviously never came to be, which is possibly for the best, because one of them sounded just awful. The Robert Luketic one. You know,
was that Expendables?
I believe so. It just sounded like such dog shit.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad it didn't happen.
Everybody should watch her YouTube channel, because she has a video where she's reviewing candy bars. That's super charming. And then there's another video where she's doing like a review of her performance in Halloween Resurrection. And it's really funny.
Oh, nice. All right. She's the best part about that movie.
Yeah, she is.
My Riddick pick, my Vin Diesel pick, is a movie that you and Rob just wrote about, and that's Babylon AD, which I picked before rewatching and probably should have rewatched first. because, I think it's like 3/4 of a very entertaining, stupid action movie. And then there's this whole last act that I'm just like, what the fuck is all this? This is terrible. There's a big, like, shootout in the street, and the movie should end right there, and it doesn't. It goes on for, like, 15, 20 more minutes. And, again, I don't know, because this was a movie that, like, got taken away from Matthew Kasovitz and recut by the studio, and he basically disowned it and tried to take his name off of it. So I don't know who to point fingers at. You know, Vin Diesel is basically playing Vin Diesel once again. He has one mode. So he's doing Riddick and Dominic Toretto and every cool guy ever as this mercenary whose job it is to get this woman from point A to point B. And so it's, you know, Children of Men and however many other dystopian sci-fi movies. But for three-fourths of it, I think it's like brainlessly entertaining. And that's the part that I'll recommend. I can't recommend the last act of this movie, but... And you were much more fond of it than Rob, because I remember reading the column and feeling like, okay, Adam and I are on the same page about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, it's the silliness of Babylon AD, like, really won me over early.
Yeah.
And then there's just moments in it that are really memorable for me, even if the movie itself isn't great. Like, and I agree with you that the last, like, 15, 20 minutes, it's like the movie just gives up. It's like, it makes no sense at all.
No, it's real bad.
And the only reason, like, why they kept it in is because the movie is, like, real short anyway,
right,
probably.
Exactly, so, yeah, for sure.
But there's three moments in Babylon AD that I love, and it's like, oh, Vin, I could never be mad at you. One is at the beginning. He's got a gun drawn on this guy, and he just goes, a man only has two things in this world, your balls and your word. And I'm just like... oh, God. There's nothing I love more than in movies when people say there's only two things, or like there's only one of two people in this. And then I'm just like, oh, I can't wait to hear what the options are, because it's something that only happens in movies and TV shows. The second one is there's a scene where a guard is facing towards the camera, basically like facing the audience on screen. And he's got his gun up, and there's a scene where Vin Diesel runs past him and just steals his gun, and then the guy goes, hey, and then like Michelle Yeoh's right behind him and then just punches him in the face, and then they cut away real quick, and I'm like, haha, stupid guard. And then the third one is there's a scene during like that street chase thing where he needs to like duck a missile coming at him, and he runs towards the car, throws a gun at the windshield, and then just jumps through the windshield and like
one fluid.
And it's just the way it's shot. It's like really, really hilarious. But yeah, Babylon AD, it's like you mentioned Children of Men. It's like Fifth Element too.
Yeah.
It's a big goofy movie, but I have some fondness for it.
In retrospect, I probably should have picked like XXX, but I don't know if that's really underrated.
I think it might be.
It's really stupid. Like, I don't even love it that much, but I probably like it more than Babylon AD.
Rank the XXX movies.
One, then two. I know everybody loves the second one, but I think I like the first one better if for no other reason than Asia Argento.
Boy, people love XXX State of the Union?
Oh, gosh. Sorry. 1, 3, 2. I forgot State of the Union. I was only in the Diesel verse.
Yeah.
1, 3, 2.
Yeah. I think I'm 1, 3, 2 also.
People love the third one, not State of the Union. Although I will admit that when the third one does bring in Ice Cube, I was like, I'm so on board for this because it's that Fast Five thing where it like ties everything together.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. I love when a movie does that.
I liked at the beginning of XXX3 where he steals cable for all the villagers. And it's like,
oh, he's a hero on a skateboard.
And he loves doing that because he did that in Fast 8 also, where it's just like, like he's like the Don Corleone of Cuba.
Right? I still haven't rewatched Fast 8 since theaters. I don't even think I own it.
Dom Corleone. Anyways. the Fast and Furious, yeah, Fate of the Furious is still terrible. I've tried it so many times. When I did a rewatch of the entire series with Rob during quarantine, that was like the only one where we were like, oh, maybe this time. And it's just like, oh, no, no. No.
All right.
But good thing Cypher's coming back. So
She's the heart of the family. All right, my last pick is one Keanu Reeves, and my pick for him is a movie he not only stars in but directed, and that is Man of Tai Chi, starring Tiger Chen as Tiger Chen, which I love. He's playing himself, him and Zoe Bell, and he gets into the competitive fight world. Keanu Reeves is the villain. It seems like not everybody loves Keanu Reeves' turn as the villain. I think it's inspired. I think he knows exactly what movie he's in. I think he knows exactly the way he wants to play that part. I think he's very, very funny and very entertaining. The fight scenes are awesome. Tiger Chen is adorable. And I wish Keanu Reeves directed more action movies because he's really good at it. And he's only done the one. But it's a really solid one that I think I wish more people talked about.
I agree with you totally on this one. I'm a big fan. I like that it's like a competitive fighting movie, but also like this kind of like Keanu's playing like an Enter the Dragon, like bad guy in it. And I love in the final fight scene with Tiger Chen, where you just see the disparity of kind of their sizes, and like you're like, whoa, Keanu Reeves has giant tree trunk legs.
Yeah,
like,
he totally does.
He's just so huge. When you see him kind of like in a kung fu or a tai chi or whatever type of scene. And yeah, I think I like all the Tiger Chen stuff with like the girl at like the office building that he has to go to. It's very like it reminds me of like the Jackie Chan romance scenes.
Yeah, totally.
In his movies. And Keanu Reeves has a part in this movie that genuinely scares me, where he just growls at the screen and I think, and it frightens me because his face makes a face that's got devil and the angel that I know that is Keanu Reeves. I crack up so much when he's just like, you owe me a life.
Right. It's so funny.
It's great.
Yeah. What is your Keanu pick?
It was a choice between Johnny Mnemonic, which I rewatched last year for Junesploitation and found myself liking more than I used to. But I had to pick one that I've been defending for 18 years. And rewatching it this time, I'm not sure if I did the right thing. it's The Matrix Reloaded. What it all comes down to after this recent viewing is I love the foyer fight scene, which also has Tiger Chen in it.
Yes, it does.
And I really like the expressway action sequence.
Great sequence.
Those are great. It's like a perfect 30-minute stretch of a movie. And the rest of it is a soggy bread bowl.
It's problematic. This is the least I ever liked it, which surprised
me. Same here. Yeah,
I saw it a couple times in the theater, and I remember at the time everybody complaining about the rave scene and me being like, who cares about the rave scene? Like, it's fine. It's like they all think they're going to die. They want to dance and fuck. I get it. But, you know, it's like not what I would put in a movie, but it's not my movie. But yeah, just all the stuff with the Oracle and the architect, and it's the Wachowskis kind of buying into some nonsense that I'm not on board with. I think most of the action works. You and I talked a little bit over text. I don't love the Burly Brawl sequence because of the special effects involved.
Yeah.
I think it goes a little too far. There's a point at which I think it works, and then they push it even further, which is their way, and I appreciate that. It's something I admire about them, but once it starts to bend its own reality further than they're able to achieve via special effects, I think it starts to fall apart. I'm with you. That whole sequence that you're describing is fantastic and amazing, but the rest of the movie is not great. Although I think I still would take it over the Matrix Revolutions.
I would too. I think that the problem for me, maybe with Matrix Reloaded, why I didn't like it as much this time, is I used to argue, I'm like, well, the ideas don't really amount to anything, but at least it's a movie with ideas and philosophies and things like that. But it's just all like gobbledygook nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
And since none of it by any means pays off in the third one almost is like a Rise of Skywalker situation where it's like so busy just doing something else that it right. kind of is pretending like the second one doesn't exist, which is weird for a movie that came out 6 months later. It was shot back to back. The thing that I think brought Matrix Reloaded down a bit is all the philosophy stuff and like kind of the lore of the world of the Matrix was done better in the Animatrix. And this was the first time I've seen the Matrix Reloaded since I first watched the Animatrix.
Interesting. I don't think I've watched the Animatrix since it first came out on DVD, like prior to these sequels coming out.
I think the Animatrix is a lot closer to the original Matrix than it is to the sequels. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as the Matrix. Right. That's a classic, but
it's a perfect movie. The Animatrix
has a lot of great stuff in it. And it's pretty creepy at times too, which I wouldn't expect from this type of movie. But one thing I do like about the Matrix Reloaded is I have a fondness for the big amped up summer sequel to the surprise hit original.
Sure.
So this is the one where it's like, here's all the endorsements. Here's POD and Dave Matthews Band on the soundtrack with Rob Zombie and Linkin Park and Linkin Park and stuff like that. I just liked all the like the merchandising shit of it. So it makes me like kind of hyped in that way. But what am I getting excited about? I'm getting excited about like cherry picking a couple great action scenes, and that's about it.
It's still, quite an achievement and represents a very specific vision, and I appreciate that. But I just can't get on board with a lot of the narrative stuff, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm super curious about what they're going to do with the fourth
Me
one.
Me too.
I'm surprised that Fishburne's not in it, considering he's like one of the only ones that lived at the end of the
right.
third one.
Right. Yeah. No, I have no idea what to expect from this one. And, Wachowskis are a little bit hit or miss for me. When they hit so hard. And then when they miss, they kind of miss almost as badly for me.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, that's the most anticipated movie of the year for me is the fourth Matrix movie. So can't wait.
All right. We did it. 10 actors, 20 movies, over 2 hours. What an epic.
It was as bloated as a sequel show should be.
Right? Who's doing our music? Did you figure it out yet?
Oh, boy. Hold on. I got it. I wasn't ready for it right
now. Oh, no,
now,
we don't have to decide right now. No, absolutely. We can wrap up the show and you can just send it to me. But let's wrap up the show. Thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you, Adam, for watching 20 movies to do this show. That is no small achievement. So thank you for committing to it so hard.
Yeah, definitely.
As always, you can find us every day at fthismovie.com. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review the show if you are a fan. It helps us out a great deal. Thanks again, Adam.
Did you hear that new F This Movie, Tom? It's fantastic.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.